Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. We are approaching the 4th of July weekend when summer activities are normally in full swing. The coronavirus pandemic has canceled many of the artistic endeavors that artists and art organizations rely on. Today, we talk about some of those hit hardest, but also look at fears and opportunities as we look to the future. With us is Julie Wake, Executive Director of the Arts Foundation of Cape Cod. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning, Mindy.
Also, Anita Walker, the executive director of the Mass Cultural Council, at least for the rest of the day. Anita, you're retiring, and today's your last day after, what, 13 years?
Yes, it is my last day. I still can't believe it, but it's the end of an amazing 13 years here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Oh, we're glad we could catch you today. Now, Anita, the Mass Cultural Council has done this. Well, it's first day, the arts and culture economy is absolutely huge. I think people are really surprised when they hear the number of just how big that economy is in the state.
Well, we're part of the third largest industry in Massachusetts, which, as you would know well on the Cape, is tourism. And we have some parts of the Commonwealth, particularly the Cape and the Berkshires, for whom tourism is the heart and soul of the economy. And it is our cultural organizations that are attracting visitors literally from all over the world. And we love bringing money in from elsewhere. That's really additive to our economy. We did a study. We've done actually two studies of the impact of COVID on our field. The most recent one was April 22nd. And as of that day, our organizations have reported over $250 million in real-time losses. Now, that's just what it's stacked up as of April 22nd. Today, not only is my retirement day, but it's the deadline for our third survey in which we're asking organizations what has been the impact so far and, importantly, what is it going to cost you to reopen? It isn't a matter of just flipping a light switch and we're all back on again. There is a cost to bringing our organizations back online.
Yeah. Julie, the Arts Foundation of Cape Cod also sent out a survey that's specific to Barnstable County. What did you find?
Yeah, the losses are tremendous. As Anita mentioned, it was like overnight where people just had the rug ripped out from underneath them, especially our gig musicians and artists that teach. What we've seen on the Cape is, you know, we actually employ over 7,000 year-round people in the creative economy, which is pretty big for a population of 200,000. And what we've seen is that it's the expected losses for 2020 are almost $4 million, and that was just a survey that we took over the past month or so. And for individual artists, you know, I got a lot of comments for the individual survey where it was a lot when we asked, you know, what was the income due to COVID. And right now we're over $1 million for individual losses.
This doesn't include Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, right? This is just Barnstable County we're talking about?
Yes, Barnstable County, correct.
Yeah. Wow. So it's higher when you look at the islands as well. We often, in times of cutbacks, see art programs the first to go. And I'm wondering, in this very different kind of crisis, and there are those who understand the importance of the arts, if we are seeing donations above and beyond. I know for us, we certainly have been amazed at the support that we've had from our supporters, going beyond what their normal commitment is. And I'm thinking that that might be happening in the arts community. Julie, are we seeing that?
Absolutely. We are seeing, it's kind of been an interesting opportunity to meet new donors, actually, who are in great support of the arts, who really feel a connection and know the critical impact it has on mental health and equity and connecting community. So we are seeing quite a bit of an uptick in support.
Mm-hmm. Anita, is that the same statewide?
I think it's probably a mixed bag, depending on where you are. One of the things, though, that we were very, very pleased with is right after COVID hit, we launched a program called Safe Harbors. And this was sort of a twofold assault on the problem. Number one, to try to get a little bit of money into the hands of our organizations. We sent just little stipends out to all of the organizations that we fund. But more importantly, since our resources were limited, we wanted to make sure that our nonprofit cultural organizations had access to the CARES Act funding that was coming out of the federal government, specifically out of the Small Business Administration. So the first week, we put together a series of webinars. We had 16 webinars. We had over 1,100 organizations participate. And as a result of that training, literally 100% of the organizations that took part in that training were successful in their application to the CARES Act for federal funding, and collectively they brought in more than $21 million of federal funding to our cultural sector, about $163,000 per organization on average.
Wow. Julie, how did unemployment work with you? A lot of our artists are self-employed. Have they been eligible for unemployment? What happened on that front?
Yeah, so the unemployment insurance did evolve into becoming an opportunity for our contractors, our gig workers to apply. What we saw in our survey is about half the people that took the survey applied for the funding. So we're really curious and want to dig deeper into why not as many people applied. But we have seen, when the crisis hit, we did something similar to Safe Harbors at a much smaller scale. And I actually want to say thank you to Anita, because the Arts Foundation did receive a stipend from the Safe Harbor. So thank you for that, Anita. That was much needed.
I'm glad.
And we started a Cape Cod Arts Relief Fund. And so we went out and created this emergency fund for individual artists. And it kind of had a two phases to it. One was to help the individual artists right away with a quick little stipend to help with, paying gigs, missed gigs or studio space or materials to keep people creative. And we saw a huge, application rate. And then once the unemployment was evolved into contractors could apply for it, we saw a reduction in applications, which was a good thing, right? And so the phase two of the funding that we did raise will go towards cultural organizations in this next phase of recovery, which we're all trying to figure out, what is everybody going to need? Obviously we're going to need funding, but it's got to go beyond that and dig deeper. And I know Mass Cultural Council has really done a good job and had already been ahead of that even before the pandemic with personal and professional development for the artist and the cultural organization. But I think it's going to be really critical now. What we've seen here, I meet with quite a few arts leaders here, and, it's kind of unanimous that we're going to survive 2020. 2021 is the unknown. That's going to be really a tough thing to kind of, it's going to be a challenging year.
Yeah. Anita, what are some, are there some legislative initiatives in the works that would somehow help?
Yeah, there is one piece of legislation that has been submitted by the representatives, two from the Berkshires, Representative Barrett and Representative Pignatelli, that would appropriate $75 million directly through the Mass Cultural Council into the cultural sector to address the impact of COVID. At the moment, we don't actually have a hard number on what real costs are, but we know $75 million is an excellent start. It isn't really going to cover the losses that are the deep hole that our organizations are in right now. But as Julie said, it's not just money. It's wherewithal. It is expertise. It is what are the best practices? What are the new strategies? What is a business model that can be supporting my organizations when perhaps our audiences are going to have to be smaller due to social distancing? What kind of investment am I going to have to make in my building to make sure that the air quality is safe? So there are a lot of issues that our organizations are grappling with. It can be overwhelming, and it also can be overwhelming because people feel like they're getting mixed messages. Are we opening? Are we closing? And this fits and starts, I think, of the way that the coronavirus is being handled, I think, is also unsettling. I had a great conversation yesterday with the fellow who runs the Healthy Buildings Program at Harvard, and he said, we're all just going to have to get used to adapting. adapting. Things are going to be changing. We may be told we can open, and then all of a sudden we may be told we have to close, and that's just going to be part of the new reality.
Yeah, and all these things you're listing, one of that psychological impact is huge.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely huge. And Julie, I do want to thank you for mentioning, because this is also of concern to us. Right before the coronavirus hit, we were rolling out a new program called Culture RX, which was recognizing that social isolation and loneliness leads to serious health consequences, not just depression, but suicide and even heart disease. And we know that the arts are a protective factor in connecting people and keeping people healthy. And we were just rolling out this new program to support the health and well-being that is associated with the arts, when the very thing we were trying to correct became the way to protect ourselves from the coronavirus, which is social isolation. So when we start to come out the other end of it, we're going to see not only people who have had a life experience of loneliness and isolation, but a whole population that's never been isolated before, and we'll feel the mental health consequences of that as well.
Yeah. You know, when we talk about the importance of arts, I mean, there's so many different directions we can go, but I was just thinking of a story, and I think this was at the Kituat Center for the Arts, where a school group had gone through, and this one kid just kept asking all of these questions, and, you know, just was really, I guess, very passionate about what was happening. And, you know, whoever was doing this, you know, answering the questions, but at the end, the teacher was saying, this child doesn't speak up like that. This was like a moment for this child that was really just connecting with whatever, you know, the collection was at that time. And it's really so important on so many levels that I think sometimes we forget that, besides it being fun, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes a more engaged student. They're more engaged and interested in the world, and you see it when you see classrooms of children going off and into galleries and museums and theater. It's definitely something that we all need in our communities.
Yeah. Anita, you mentioned one of the things we don't know is what the real cost will be. And is that one of the things, you mentioned the survey that's ending today. Is that one of the things you're trying to get at with this current survey? What kind of information are you looking for?
Yes, that's exactly right. We're also going to take another dipstick into what the real economic effects of COVID have been. But if we're going to reopen and recover, we feel like recovery is a thing in and of itself. It's not just reeling from the damage, but it is how do we take steps forward to recover? And how do we equip our field to be able to do so successfully? The one thing we know our organizations and our communities want is they want to open, but they want to be safe. They want their staff to be safe, and they want their audiences to be safe. And how do they assure that? And what we're starting to understand is this is really going to be a layered approach. It's not just one thing. It's not just the visible part, the hand sanitizer, and maybe having people sit every other seat. But is where are other places and spaces where people bunch up together, either in line to come in or in the lobbies? And what about the air filtration system? When's the last time we've taken a look at that? Is that effective? Are we getting an exchange of air? Because it's really about diluting the coronavirus in the context of where people are. And that dilution factor is really part and parcel of the air quality within our buildings. You know, interesting enough, I know you're all probably aware, we have spent decades talking about the air quality outside, but we actually spend 90% of our time inside buildings, and the air quality is invisible, and we actually frequently fail to think about it. Joe Allen, who runs the Healthy Buildings Program at Harvard, told me, he said, the building maintenance engineer has a greater impact on your health than your doctor.
It's amazing we think about it, yeah. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on the arts and cultural communities. With us is Julie Wake, Executive Director of the Arts Foundation of Cape Cod, and Anita Walker, the Executive Director of the Mass Cultural Council. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626 if you'd like to share your thoughts with us. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jung Ho Pak is on the phone. He's the Artistic Director and Conductor at the Cape Symphony and Conservatory. Good morning, Jung Ho.
Good morning, Mindy. How are you?
good. And so you, Anita, mentioned looking at your business model, and that's exactly what you are doing at this moment, right?
Completely. You know, this has been an interesting time of change for all of us. But even prior to the pandemic, we were poised for some major evolution. We've got a new executive director, Michael Albaugh, came to us from the Philadelphia Orchestra. And with Ellen Dickinson and the board, we were ready for some major decisions and changes and evolution. But, you know, we see the pandemic is actually accelerating those decisions, things that really need to be made. And it's, you know, for some people, it might say this has actually been a great opportunity for us to message that. So, for example, we're taking a look at ways that we can diversify our income. I think a lot of arts organizations may be one-trick ponies and getting income through one source, and we're looking at broadening that. We also see that we're just not just a symphony or a conservatory, but we can be a rich resource of talent and expertise. Maybe we should see our musicians more than just people who play instruments well, but they can be ambassadors, and we can put them into hospitals and public schools and even outlying communities, which there are a lot on the Cape. So really, I think all of us, including musicians, want to be more relevant and impactful, and this is our chance to do that.
Yeah, and of course now we're looking at so much that's going online, and I think I know I've been surprised how much you can actually do online that we thought could only be done in person before.
Oh, you are so right. It is actually a wake-up call for all arts organizations and artists to realize that we're not just artists because we say we're artists. Actually, everyone in the world is an artist from their living room. And I think what we're seeing is a DIY era for the soul, that people are getting back to making bread in their kitchen and getting back to being creative in their living rooms. And I think it should be humbling, but I think it should also be inspiring that our goal is not just to show, but to maybe fuel this fire that's happening in our society, that people are being more creative.
Yeah. And I think one of the other things that you mentioned to me that you're working on is reevaluating mission and goal.
Yeah. You know, no longer art for art's sake, but maybe art for life's sake. That maybe we know that there's a hunger out there for creativity and inspiration. And we also know that there's need for comfort, for loneliness and connectivity. And maybe that's why art exists. Maybe that's why we should step up and actually take a much more central role in making our society stronger.
Yeah. Chung Ho Park, thanks so much for calling in this morning and sharing your thoughts. I think it gives some optimism to many of us. Thanks for that.
Absolutely. Julie, thank you so much.
You bet. Julie or Anita, anything you want to add to what Chung Ho was saying?
Yeah, seen a great opportunity for virtual offerings. And we have actually moved a summer concert series online. We're really lucky our sponsor, TD Bank, wanted to support our local musicians. And so we're moving forward with that. But one of the things that we learned early on when we did a fundraiser for our Arts Relief Fund, a three-day virtual arts festival, and one thing we learned was, you know, we really need to put our best faces on first. Like, first impressions make a big difference. And so what we've learned is we've started to work with our local musicians and artists to train them on a virtual capacity, because not everybody, it's not natural for everybody. So it's really, like Jung Ho said, it's a great opportunity to connect with a much broader audience. But you have to do it right, and it has to be good and consistent.
Yeah. Anita?
Well, actually, 2 points, and such a great set of comments. First, you are absolutely right, Julie. What the digital world has done is created global access to the amazing artistic talent that we have here right in our own backyard. But we are working with organizations and artists whose business model typically is to create a product and sell it for half of what it costs to make. When we have seen a lot of the work happening digitally, we're creating our product and basically giving it away. It has been great for engagement. It has been great for that social capital and keeping connected with our audiences and growing audiences. But at the end of the day, the work doesn't happen if we don't pay for it. So I think one of the challenges of the digital connection is going to be how we can monetize that and make sure that our artists are being paid, because this is work of value and should be paid. But I think the other point that the caller made that I think is so incredibly important is that our organizations and our cultural field has a relationship of trust with its audience. It's really a partnership. There is no arts if it's just a one-way street. And I think this is one of the things that has been thriving in Massachusetts, is this relationship of trust between our organizations, our theaters, our museums, our dance companies, and the audiences that love them. That trust is going to have to carry the day as we make our way through COVID. It is not going to be a situation where audience members leave it up to the theater or the museum to make sure they're safe. We all have to participate. This is a collective responsibility. If you go to the theater, if you go to the museum, you need to make sure that you don't have a temperature, that you're wearing a face mask, that you're doing your part to make sure that everybody who participates in the arts together, which is where our strength lies, that we're all doing our part.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626 if you'd like to share your thoughts on opportunities and fears during this pandemic. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. If you have something interesting happening with your organization, Hal Brooks is on the line from the Cape Cod Theater Project. Hi, Hal.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good. How about you?
Just fine, thank you. Getting started this week.
Yeah. So tell us what you're doing.
Yeah, sure. What we do is we develop new plays. Our mission is to support and contribute to the vitality of the American theater. Every week in July, usually, we bring up a cast of playwrights, directors, and actors. We develop a play over the course of the week, and we present it three times in front of our audience. So this year, obviously, we've had to make a big pivot. And our feeling was that it's vital now, when so many theaters have closed due to the pandemic, to do something. And it's vital to our artists to have them work. And it's vital to our audiences here. So what we've done is we've done virtual programming. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. Keep going. I think we might have lost. Yeah, go ahead.
So what we pivoted, we're doing virtual programming. All of our plays are being live streamed. All of the actors, of course, are in different locations. We've been able to bring up a playwright. We'll be able to bring up another playwright and a director, but it's all happening virtually. And we've had our first experiments this week. We've had, an engagement, a question and answer with the playwright and the director, and it went great. So, you know, it's sort of out of this strange opportunity. We're trying to make something happen, and it appears to be working. We have seen an incredible outpouring from our audience in terms of donations. And that's been true from on a foundational level as well. And so that has been absolutely terrific. Yeah.
One of the things I would say, in a lot of ways, you're really positioned to be successful at this, because the plays that you're putting on, they aren't these big lavish sets and everything. It's sort of a work in progress, if you will. And you've had great success with some of the playwrights that you've brought in the past.
Indeed, we have. You know, some of the plays that we have brought up here have had lives regionally, off-Broadway, and we've had several that have gone on to Broadway, including a play called Hillary and Clinton that was written by Lucas Naith. One of our playwrights in residence, Heidi Schreck, went on to Broadway with her play, What the Constitution Means to Me. We're very proud of that history. And this year, you know, is no different. We want to develop these plays, but at some point we will once again be in person. And it is important that these plays be ready. So we have plays that are covering, you know, a vast array of relevance. Our first play is a one-man show, which I think is incredibly conducive to this new medium that we're playing with, which is this weird combination of both theater and film in a way. And it's starring the founder of the Cape Cod Theater Project, Andrew Polk. And it's a play written by Michelle Lowe called Moses.
Right. All right. Well, we'll can have links to everybody's website who talks to us today later at our website, capeandislands.org. Hal Brooks, thanks so much for calling Cape Cod Theater Project. Good luck with your season. Hope it goes well. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. And I just say everybody should try to stay optimistic and keep creating.
Right. Performing artists are perhaps struggling more than those who can create in their studios. And Julie, you mentioned gig musicians earlier who would love to be performing in person, but you know, there's this fear for some of their bandmates who may have compromised immune systems. So I know there have been some virtual performances, but it's tough when you've got, you know, a band or an orchestra that we're talking about.
Oh, absolutely. It's almost impossible. And, you know, when you're, I think some musicians, mostly solo and duo, are having some opportunities right now. It's touch and go, as we mentioned, where it's, as Anita mentioned, it's like, you know, we might be moving forward to open and then we might not. But the smaller duos and the soloists are getting some opportunities, but it's really tough. You don't want to put musicians in a place where they have to police the audience for social distancing. So I have a concern about that, about putting musicians in kind of these vulnerable positions.
Yeah, we're talking, and then we talked earlier about the psychological impact and, you know, okay, maybe we can do some outdoor performances and then, well, maybe not. And there's all this uncertainty. And I think there's a lot of confusion about the mask. I mean, we're starting to hear more about you should wear the mask all the time out in public, but we've had those mixed messages like wear it if you can't social distance. And that makes some people nervous. So messaging is really important here, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, singing, they're saying, is a big contributor to the spread. You know, there's certain instruments as well. So nobody wants to be a spreader. And what I have seen working with our arts leaders who have been incredibly patient and innovative with their plans and thoughtful about thinking about their patrons and their staff, everybody just really wants to stay safe and, you know, have something to produce for their audiences. But it's been safety first. And, you know, and creativity is still coming. You know, it's still there. We're seeing it everywhere.
Yeah. Anita, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, there is, as Julie said, our field is incredibly resilient. It's creative. A singer will sing, a dancer will dance, a writer will write. I mean, this is something you can't not do it. And so our artists, our organizations are finding way to continue to serve their communities and serve the public with the arts. But you mentioned people in choruses and singing. I think this is an area that has a particular concern. One of the serious cases of coronavirus did break out in the midst of a choral event, and there were many victims in that particular instance. And I think I've heard from the National Service Organization for Choruses that they are thinking it may be we need a vaccine before they're really able to get back into singing together. Obviously, social distancing, outdoors, any place where the environment can be diluting the aerosol that we spray when we speak. We're all spraying aerosol when we open our mouths and start to communicate. And singing is a lot like the projection of coughing. So that's why it's one of the more vulnerable areas in terms of the coronavirus. But again, we're all going to have to adapt. The science is there and solid around wearing masks and social distancing and air circulation. It is known, it is real science, but I think as we evolve collectively in this huge global social experiment where we are all trying to do the thing, the right thing together in order to lick this novel virus, we will all be learning together along the way.
Right. Richard is giving us a call from Oak Bluffs. Good morning, Richard.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I just wanted to point out, I think this discussion is missing a major, I mean, I'd like to say five words: Black Lives Matter, George Floyd. It isn't just this moment. There's a lot of energy. A lot of energy goes into the streets, and artists have a role to play there. Mm-hmm. And emphasis on economics and just talking about how art digitally is really missing the mark. I think this is the moment that I think the MCC puts too much emphasis on what the finances are of the arts. From my point of view, the arts locally, the financial situation generally tames the arts. We're in a moment where people are going in the streets and they're actually presenting their work to the public. Put a mask on and go out and do it. I've been messing around with the Civil War monument here and a George Floyd banner and interacting with the public, and it's been great.
Yeah. Yeah. Richard, thanks for sharing your thoughts. Appreciate that. Elaine Lipton is calling from the Cape Cod Chamber Music Festival. Hi, Elaine.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
Go ahead. I just wanted to say thank you both to the Arts Foundation of Cape Cod and to the Mass Cultural Council for all that they have done to help organizations navigate through some of this, both financially and through, ways to move forward. And I think that they've been great. I think we've all had to reinvent ourselves a little bit. And I think the ideas of quality and safety and diversity and monetization have all been on our chief on our plates in terms of figuring out how we do this. And I think it's a tremendous opportunity, and I think we're rising to the challenge.
Mm. Elaine, how's your organization faring through this?
We are doing okay. We are, we have an audience that is at risk both in terms of health and in terms of isolation. And we're trying to do what we can to keep music in front of them as much as we can. We're doing a lot of emailing people concerts to listen to at home. We will be doing a virtual season instead of 12 live concerts in August. We're putting together three radio programs of archived concerts and then a montage of work by musicians who've come to perform for us before. And then in late August, we will actually do a live concert recording with a very small audience. And we will do that actually in New York, but then distribute it as much as possible everywhere to our audience. And our audience, as you had pointed out earlier, is very, very dedicated to us and have been great at helping us stay afloat and continue.
Mm. Elaine Lipton, Cape Cod Chamber Music Festival. Elaine, thanks for calling and sharing your thoughts. We're listening to The Point. We are talking about the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on the arts, looking at fears and opportunities as we look to the future. If you'd like to share your thoughts, how you're feeling or what you're doing as an artist or an art organization, give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. As we're just sort of saying, artists are, as we know, very creative people and come up with amazing ideas. They can't just sit and not create. It's in their DNA. Julie, what are some examples of things that you've been seeing during this pandemic when people can't get together in person? We've been seeing a lot of really interesting things happening virtually. Any other thoughts of things going on?
Yeah, I've seen some really creative things going on that catch my eye sometimes scrolling through my social media, such as, you know, poetry in the kitchen while you're cooking and, live music and, conversations. It's been an interesting time to learn more. I feel like I'm actually becoming more culturally literate by having this time to really explore what's happening, not only here, but learning throughout, the world about the impact. And can you imagine if we didn't have the arts right now and what social media would look like? Because we know that this is a connector. It's making people feel like it's a much smaller world, that we're all in it together. And one of the things that Jung Ho didn't mention this, but the Cape Conservatory has actually, and I love hearing stories like this, and this is creative in a different way, and it's kind of overlapping into community needs. But the conservatory has been operating as an emergency daycare center. through EEC. And so this is for our emergency workers and their families, and they've been able to take these kids in when daycares have been closed. And so this has been kind of an incredible partnership that's been a little bit under the radar. I hope I'm not.
Yeah. You know. I didn't know. I knew they had a daycare in there, but I didn't know they were doing it now. That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, it's for it's an emergency daycare center. It's not, daycare centers are not open right now, but this was for frontline workers, Cape Cod healthcare workers who have small children, so they could go to work and keep us all safe. So these are the innovative ways that that the creative community overlaps into our basic human needs that we, you know, daycare is a huge problem right now. Imagine if they weren't there for our Cape Cod healthcare workers. I mean, it's just, it's incredible.
Anita, any thoughts come to mind for you?
Well, along the same lines, how many people do you know who are sequestered at home and for the first time having their children with them home all day, trying to homeschool their children, trying to follow the lesson plans, also trying to work from home? And so many of our organizations and our teaching artists, don't forget, is a group of our individual, you could call them gig workers, I guess, as well, who had lesson plans and work lined up for the school year. They teach in the classroom. They augment and help provide a top-notch education for our kids. And when the schools closed, all of a sudden their work ended. But they weren't about to let that happen. And every teaching artist I know, literally on a dime, turned around and made a virtual outreach program out of the lessons that they were going to take into the schools. And what that added benefit included was providing activities for kids at home, including parents in those activities. You know, typically a teaching artist will go into school and it's kind of a closed system. And then the kid will come home with their artwork or whatever they've done with the teaching artist or stories, but the parent and the family members aren't a part of it. Teaching artists are telling me when they take their lessons into the home, the family's there, the parents are there, and now they've sort of expanded the reach and the participation in the activities that the children would have done only in the on their classroom site in the past. So it's an added benefit. It's not perfect. It's not the same as having the teaching artist right there with you. But whether it's music lessons or art lessons or even science, environment, or planting a garden in your backyard, our teaching artists are really helping make all that sequestered time at home with family members go a lot more smoothly.
Yeah. Let's talk to Sherry Mittenthal, who's calling from the Truro Center for the Arts. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Hi, Sherry.
Hi, everybody. I just wanted to check in. I wanted to thank, first Massachusetts Cultural Council for everything that they've done around this whole beginning of this whole pandemic. And I've also been with on the regular calls with the Arts Foundation, who've also been really, really helpful around, you know, moving forward and how we kind of reopen and what we do around the PPP and, you know, all of that, as well as Mass Creative, who's been really great. I'm calling because I feel like, you know, we've done everything we can in terms of, like, recreating our reshifting our mission, pivoting, as people like to say, the creative pivot to move to online classes, which we've launched about 30 classes for June, July, and August. And actually, they're going really well. They're going better than expected, and I think that's great. But now we're in the stage of, you know, we're able to open to do hands-on classes, and I've been getting my stuff together to move forward with my board to say, okay, can we do 12 landscape classes out in the meadow at Edgewood Farm where there's plenty of room and space with masks, with social distancing, with everything put in place, you know, questions, forms, everything. But there's still this gigonzo fear. I mean, I know that, you know, the world right now is, you know, expanding in cases all over the place. But I guess Cape Cod, and, you know, I'm pretty far at the tip here, you know, just getting people to feel comfortable even when we are putting things in place. You know, working with, you know, the other cultural organizations like PAM and Kituate Center for the Arts and the Cultural Center, like, people are opening. People are beginning to do stuff. So I don't know. I'm just calling. Yeah. I just thought I'd put it out there if there's any,
It's a good point, Sharon, and it's one that I was actually thinking of asking if there have been, Julie, any surveys, consumer surveys, as to when people might feel comfortable returning to art venues. Because I know there are certainly maybe some people who are anxious to get out, but then there are people, you know, a lot, we have an older demographic here who are the demographic that's at most risk. Julie, do you know of any, or start with you, Julie, yeah. Do you know of any surveys? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sherry, for the call.
Yeah, thanks, Sherry. It's such a good point, and we have this conversation a lot. There have been quite a few of our cultural organizations here have done surveys. I know David Keene at the Kituit Center did one. And what he found early on is that a lot of people aren't going to be comfortable until there's a vaccine. And you're right, the demographic is older. It's an older population. And as much as, you know, they're huge patrons of the arts, nobody wants to get sick. And there is a psychological impact to this. Can we trust each other? I think Anita mentioned it earlier. It's like there's a trust factor here in the community, and those, they have done these surveys for patrons, and you know, there is definitely, people are nervous. People are anxious to get back, but they're, you know, for close shoulder to shoulder types of performances, a lot of people have said they'd like to wait for a vaccine.
Yeah. Anita, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I keep coming back to, this is a shared responsibility. And hi, Sherry. It is so great to hear your voice. You sent me some lovely messages. I'm going to miss you. Come out west sometime and see me.
I will.
But to your question, Sherry, I think it's really on point. It's a shared responsibility. You are going to follow every practice that is recommended. You're going to make sure there's distance. You're going to be outside. You're going to have sanitation. You're going to require masks. All the visible practices that are recommended. But I think you need to ask your participants, the people who are taking the classes, to share the responsibility to be safe. And that means they have to attest that I don't have a fever, that I am not bringing a potential virus into the environment, even if it's outdoors, which is great because that's the dilution factor, which makes such a big difference. But I think we need to not take the responsibility 100% ourselves. We need to do everything possible, but we need to share that responsibility with our audiences, with our participants. And quite frankly, that is one of the things that gives the audience member confidence, a sense of self-determination, a sense that I'm also participating. I'm a partner with you, Sherry. I'm working with you to make this safe. I'm not just depending blindly on you to make me safe.
Yeah, good point. Sherry, thanks again for the phone call. Okay, Maddie is giving us a call from the Nantucket Book Festival. Hi, Maddie.
Hey, Mindy. How are you?
I'm good. So this, you know, one of my favorite events, and it had to be virtual this year.
I know, along with everyone else, I'm afraid.
Right.
Yeah, I was thinking that about this time last year, you and I were at the Whaling Museum broadcasting from there to launch the book festival. So.
That's right.
So, yeah, we've done a series of virtual videos that are on our website with the same authors that we were hoping to see in person on the island. And we're really proud of what we've been able to do. And I, too, want to add my thanks to the Mass Cultural Council. They followed through on their festival grants, even though there weren't a lot of festivals this year. And that really helped us out a lot.
Great. All right, Matt, is that it? That all you wanted to say?
Just thank you, too, Mindy, for having these conversations, because the nonprofits are really stretching right now to make things work and to have a voice that promotes us and applauds the efforts really helps.
Yeah. Maddie, thanks for calling. And hopefully next year we'll have that book festival on the island, we hope. Yeah. Now, Anita and Julie, one of the things that I've been really excited to see is the comeback of the drive-in, right? Who would have thought we'd be saying drive-ins would make a comeback?
even drive-in art exhibits, drive-in concerts, drive-in theater productions, drive-through exhibitions. Yeah. You know, it's kind of funny because that is kind of a throwback, but it is a strategy and it's creative, and it doesn't surprise me in the least that our field would come up with it.
Yeah, no, it's great. Yeah, and I agree. And the sound is much better, I think, now than when we used to have to put those speakers in the windows, right?
Yeah,
go ahead, Julie.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing, like the film festivals moving to a drive-in theater, it just makes sense. I mean, we're really enjoying this, you know, outdoor dining experience now. It's very European, you know, we're spending more time outside, and that's a good thing for all of us, it's a good thing.
So museums and galleries are preparing to open. What will that look like? We've heard a lot of, you know, obviously, in some ways, maybe reduced number of people in at a gallery or museum at one time actually gives you more space to see what's being exhibited, right? So, but what is it going to look like, Anita?
Well, first of all, I think we're going to have maybe some time ticketing so that you sign up for a certain time to come so that people don't bunch up. I think there's going to be attention made not just to the spacing within the galleries while you're looking at the art, but those sort of crunch zones, you know, at the entrance or where you're buying your ticket, how we're going to space out. We'll probably see the X's on the floor to keep people at a distance. We'll see signage, probably even offering masks. If you didn't happen to bring your own, a lot of sanitation, a lot of that Purell, or not to use the brand name, dispensers all over our museum so that people can maintain their good hygiene and sanitation. I think it's going to be a lot of communication to remind people of the practices that are going to be necessary and required in these spaces.
Yeah. Julie, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I was having a conversation with Chris McCarthy at the PAM in Provincetown, and you know, she was talking about how she and her staff are walking through the museum and looking at every touch point and how to keep people safe. And I'm just so impressed with, you know, so many arts leaders really thinking about how to keep people safe and keeping people connected to art. It's a priority to them, and it's you know, keeping people safe is right up there with preserving the opportunity and access to arts and culture. So it's really impressive.
Mm. Anita, we mentioned this is your last day. We wish you the best in retirement. Do you have any plans at this point?
None. Absolutely none.
I'm so jealous.
It's frightening. It's thrilling. It's probably the first day in 50 years tomorrow morning when I wake up and will not either be applying for a job, preparing for a job, going for a job, thinking of the next job, thinking about my job all night long. It is truly the blank canvas that I have never, ever experienced. And while I'm scared to death, that's what makes it so exciting.
Well, we wish you well, Anita. Anita Walker, the Executive Director of the Mass Cultural Council, and Julie Wake, Executive Director of the Arts Foundation of Cape Cod, who is not going anywhere for a long time, we hope. Thank you both for being with us and for the great work that you do. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we will have links to the organizations we talked about this morning at our website, capeandislands.org. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.